And good morning to everyone. Our first guest this morning is State versus Marvin D. Sundquist. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. We will proceed. Mr. Sundquist, good morning to you. You may approach the podium and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to thank Justices and Mr. Ralph for his time. We are here today for a DUI that occurred approximately 4 years ago. It has been briefed by both sides, and I will address the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel on the appeal to district court first. I believe the record speaks for itself. On the appeal to district court, my attorney failed to file a notice of errors and then failed to make an argument at the hearing to the district court. The state has argued that they did make an argument and that the district court made a ruling on the arguments. However, said there were no arguments made, and it is irrelevant without a statement of errors, because a statement of errors precludes any argument to be made. I'd also like to address...
Did the district court rule on the specific issue that you wanted your attorney to raise before that court?
My attorney did not raise any of the concerns that I had.
Listen to the verb. Did the district court rule on the specific issue that you had wanted to be raised?
I guess technically, yes, they did. But they did so without an argument from my attorney, and my attorney actually agreed with the judge that there was no case law to support the argument that I thought should have been made.
What argument did you want to be made?
That this trial was originally occurred 4 years ago. It went to trial. The state had failed to introduce the breathalyzer for the data master. And my attorney and I rejected a plea deal because we felt that the data master results were inaccurate because the officer wasn't trained or certified. That issue got appealed and reversed at the district court level the first time. My argument the second time was based on a long line of precedents, including Missouri versus Fry and Lafler versus Cooper, that because we couldn't make a knowledgeable decision on, you know, the plea bargain, that plea bargain should have been reoffered on appeal.
And what did the district court say about that issue?
They just dismissed it as frivolous.
Did they talk about any case law that supports your contention?
No. The district court said there was no case law that supports it, and my attorney agreed with the district court. He didn't bring up any of the Lafler versus Cooper, Missouri versus Fry. There's also...
What do you think those cases say?
Basically, in Lafler versus Cooper, which is almost identical, Lafler's attorney basically told him that there was no chance that the he could get convicted because there wasn't enough evidence, and he went to trial because of that. And then the United States Supreme Court basically said, since he was convicted and he wasn't able to analyze a plea bargain, that it got reversed.
Do you believe that the law is or should be that the prosecutor must offer the same plea deal if there's a second trial?
No, not in most circumstances. I believe if the attorney, you know, if the defendant had the opportunity to make a knowledgeable decision on the plea bargain the first time, I don't believe it's necessary, because they rejected it.
Does the knowledge you're talking about include the outcome of the first trial?
No.
Sir, at the time the state made that plea offer, were you represented by counsel, and does it matter?
Not when I made the offer, or not when the offer was made to me.
So when you made the decision to reject the offer, it wasn't based on your counsel's advice? Is that right?
The first time. What happened was, I'll get to that argument later, but I had initially rejected it without the assistance of an attorney, but then a two-week continuance was granted, and at that continuance, I was appointed an attorney. And then...
Were you offered the plea agreement again after you were...
Yes.
...attorney appointed?
It was a standing plea agreement that was available until the week of the trial. The state did not withdraw it until the week of the trial. It is the state's contention that just entering the plea at the plea hearing was the end of the plea negotiations, which under Supreme Court precedent, a defendant has the right to an attorney during plea negotiations, so that in itself would be a due process violation to end plea negotiations prior to being appointed an attorney, unless the defendant has waived their right to an attorney.
Does the defendant have a right to a plea offer?
No, they do not have a right to a plea offer, but if a plea offer is made, they have the right to due process when determining whether to accept that offer, and they have the right to an attorney, you know, to assist them in making that decision.
In what way was your lawyer ineffective in this? I understand you're alleging that the state failed to disclose something, and that because that wasn't disclosed, you contend that you weren't able to accept the offer with all the knowledge that you think you should have had. But in what way was your lawyer ineffective in that?
Well, what my argument was that the state interfered with my lawyer's ability to represent me, because if DUI is a unique offense in that a defendant does not know if they're guilty without the benefit of the breathalyzer results.
So your contention is that the state did something
right
to interfere with your rights, not your lawyer.
Right. Right. They failed to provide, in fact, they provided a certificate that led the defense to believe that the officer was not certified. And that is why the case was reversed the first time.
But that's something, again, that the state did, not your counsel.
Right. It was a decision between myself and the counsel, because the officer at that time, we believe he was not certified and the results were inaccurate. And I guess I took up most of my time here, but you know, the state's entire argument is plea bargaining closed before I was even assigned an attorney, which that in of itself is a violation of the due process, because Brady versus United States and a long line of cases say a defendant is entitled to counsel when a plea bargain is offered and cannot enter a guilty plea without the assistance of counsel or a waiver of counsel. So, I guess I'd like to reserve what little time I have left for.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. in this appeal, as I understand it, Mr. Sundquist argues basically three main things. One, that he received ineffective assistance of counsel in various respects. Two, that the state, through some wrongful conduct, essentially prevented him from accepting an earlier plea offer that was made before the first trial, and then there was a second trial following an appellate reversal. And then three, that the state's refusal to reoffer that plea deal on remand before the second trial amounted to vindictive prosecution. In short, our position is that the record is sufficient to address those ineffective claims, that they're without merit, that the claims regarding the state's wrongful conduct preventing him from accepting the plea deal are waived, and that the claims of vindictive prosecution based on the relevant case law and circumstances are likewise without merit. That's why we ask this court to affirm the district court's order. So I'll touch first on the ineffective claims. Mr. Sundquist focused on the appellate counsel claims, so I will too. And essentially, our position is, yes, it's deficient performance to not file a statement of errors on the part of his appellate counsel, but the issue he wanted presented to the district court was in fact ruled on by the district court, and so we see no prejudice in that issue.
Is this after the first trial or after the second trial?
This is after the second trial. His appellate counsel to the district court was the same counsel as that trial, the second trial, and he failed to file a statement of errors. Nevertheless, the issue, I think, was presented to the district court, ruled upon by the district court, whether essentially the state had to reoffer the plea deal from before the first trial. And all that said, too, the bill of exceptions from the county court also shows Mr. Sundquist's arguments regarding Fry and Leffler, and essentially a more detailed argument than what maybe was presented at the district court level.
So is your argument there was no prejudice?
Yes, that is our position. That's what I had in brief.
Mr. Sundquist suggested this morning that there were additional arguments that he wanted his counsel to make that were not made. What's your response to that?
I guess I didn't take it that way, and from what I understand of his brief, it was more focused on the refusal to reoffer the plea deal from before the first trial. And so like I said, I think our position is that, well, that was presented and it was ruled on and it was rejected, and so there was no prejudice. As for the claims regarding the state's misconduct, which I think, Justice Papik, you were correct, and how I understood his claim was that the failure to disclose this permit, this testing permit from the first discovery phase and first trial, essentially prevented him from accepting the plea deal. And as I said in my brief, as I understand it, I think that argument is essentially waived by the mandate branch of the law of the case doctrine, which basically says, and federal courts have talked about it quite a bit too, that if you have an opportunity and you have incentive to raise that argument in the first appeal and you don't, it's waived in future appeals following a remand. And the idea being that it doesn't make sense to give you a windfall for not making an argument when, had you made the argument, you would have been bound by the law of the case doctrine. And so I cited this court's decision in Penfield Oil, and then D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals case from the federal side as well. So I think those arguments are waived. He had the incentive and opportunity to raise that in the first appeal. He knew about the alleged violation by the state, the failure to disclose. That was the entire basis of the reversal there. And then he, of course, knew that he had rejected the plea offer as well.
Was he represented by counsel at that time?
Yes. Yes, he was.
Essentially, he's making a due process argument about the conduct of the state, right?
Yes.
And
my position
he's I heard this once by a lawyer at the Eighth Circuit who said, the skunk came in the room and you couldn't get the stink out for the rest of the case. That's what he's saying. Even with the second trial, he's still impeded in the process by virtue of this initial failure to disclose.
I think so. I think that's his argument. My point, though, is that he knew about that before the first appeal. He knew, had the incentive to raise that. If he wanted the old plea offer, he had the incentive and opportunity to raise that in the first appeal. He did not. He asked for a new trial. And so that's why I think there's a waiver argument under this mandate branch of the law of the case doctrine. That's my position.
If he had asked for the appeal to, or the plea offer to be reinstated, court have had the authority to do that.
I'm not entirely sure the, I think possibly the, like the Lafler and the Fry cases talk about at least the authority to order the state to reoffer a plea bargain.
So on remand from the district court, they would have required the county attorney to reoffer the plea?
I think conceivably that could have happened, yes. But again, he didn't make that argument. He's making it now, and I think that's too late. As far as the vindictive prosecution claim, essentially that the state was required to reoffer it here, I relied in my brief on the Ninth Circuit's decision, U.S. v. Joseph, which I, in my research, was the closest case that I could find. It was pretty much on point. And they basically reiterated, one, that there's no constitutional right to a plea bargain. Two, when a defendant rejects a plea bargain, he has no ability to question the state's proceeding on the original charges. And that the doctrine of vindictive prosecution really doesn't apply when the charges and sentence remain exactly the same, which is what happened here.
Counsel, I'd like to return to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue.
Of appellate counsel, Your Honor?
Yes. We have to bear in mind in this case, I think, that the appeal, the only appeal to which this individual was constitutionally entitled to counsel was the appeal from county court to district court. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
He's only entitled to counsel on a single appeal.
Yes, that was your decision, Hugan.
Well, and I'm lots of...
Yeah, well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, lots of other ones backing that up, but... In some instances, counsel's failure could be so deficient as to be non-performance. And hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court, in circumstances like that, presumed prejudice? And where, and I hadn't thought about this until sitting here this morning listening to these arguments. Isn't there a pretty good rationale for presuming prejudice when a defendant loses his the sole appeal that he has constitutionally provided right to a lawyer because that lawyer fails to file a statement of errors, which you agree is deficient performance? Why shouldn't prejudice be presumed? My long way around to this question.
Well, because I guess a failure to file a statement of errors doesn't preclude review. All it does is say, district court, look at plain error. Still look at the case, still address issues that it may find. And it doesn't prevent the court from actually addressing issues, even on a non-plain error basis, which is what, there's several decisions from the Court of Appeals that I recall that has done that, where district court actually addresses whatever the issue was, even though a statement of errors wasn't filed. And they review it not on a plain error basis, but on whatever the general standard of review basis is. So I don't think that the failure to file a statement of errors prevents review. And when the district court in this decision, in this case, addressed the issue and rejected it, I don't see that it would make sense to make a presumed prejudice argument under the, I think you're talking about like chronic and things like that. From SCOTUS. So, in this instance, because a failure to file a statement of errors while deficient performance doesn't prevent review, I don't think a presumption of prejudice makes sense.
I think where Justice Castle is going is that, let's say this is a deficient performance, there's a range, and in this case, it's a constitutional deficiency. You have entitled to effective counsel.
Which is
different than some other errors that could have occurred by the lawyer in the first appeal.
Sure, but I mean that's true of any Strickland analysis. You're looking at it from a constitutional perspective. Deficient performance, I think, under Strickland is a constitutional issue. And so I don't think just because there's deficient performance that means that there's...
So we're not confused. This is a constitutional issue.
Sure, yeah, effective assistance of counsel, and like Justice Castle said, you know, he's entitled to an appeal under a long line of SCOTUS cases. And so, yes, it is a constitutional issue. I just don't think that it rises to the level of presumed prejudice that Chronic and other SCOTUS cases are talking about.
Before you sit down, going back to the very first trial and the alleged failure to disclose the certificate, do you have an opinion about whether or not the district court in that appeal came to the right conclusion?
It's difficult to say 100% without the Bill of Exceptions from that trial, which is not in the record. But from the Court of Appeals summary affirmance of that appeal, it was later appealed by the defendant on double jeopardy grounds. The Court of Appeals summarily affirmed. They indicated, based on State v. Obermeyer, that really there's no obligation to disclose that information because the officer can simply testify, I have a permit. And I don't know from the record exactly what exhibits maybe were planned to be offered from the Bill of Exceptions. It seems like there was just an objection, or from the transcript, excuse me, there's just an objection to the officer's testimony, and then they wanted to bring in this permit. Well, if the permit was never planned on being offered as evidence, I don't know that it would have been a discovery violation.
You don't think it would be required under the cases that refer ribbons and seals about the matter?
No. So long story short, my instinct is to say that there was no violation. The district court got it wrong. I can't say that with 100% certainty because
There was never any legal infirmity
right. In
this case at all.
Right. But I can't say that with 100% certainty because I don't have the Bill of Exceptions before me. Unless this court has further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next case of the day is...
I think he had some rebuttal.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, 57 seconds.
57 seconds. We'll give you a minute. Mr. Sandoval.
Pardon me.
Sundquist.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would like to address the issue of whether requesting the same plea at the second trial would have made a difference. That plea was requested prior to the second trial, and the state's exact response was, we do not plea after a jury trial, and Mr. Sundquist should remember that next time. And to me, if that's not vindictive, that's, you know, we're not going to plea because you appealed your case.
I think what Mr. Ralph is contending is that you were obligated to argue to the court that the court should order the state to award the initial plea offer. Was right. That argument made in the first proceeding?
That argument was made.
Where would we find that in our record?
That would be in the briefs from the first. It's not in the record today. It was an argument that my attorney made on the previous appeal, and it was an argument that my appellate or trial attorney also made, that we rejected that plea bargain because of their discovery errors. But, you know, the fact that the case was remanded gave the state the opportunity to correct that mistake and reoffer the plea since it was rejected because of the discovery errors. You know, so the prejudice didn't occur until the state refused to reoffer the plea, which the defendant did ask for, both during the appeal process, after it was remanded, and it is in record prior to the first case, or prior to the second case. I think it's on page 13 of the Bill of Exceptions, where the defendant requested that plea bargain. And as far as the presumed prejudice, I believe both Strickland versus Washington and Brady versus Maryland, I believe, both indicate that there is a presumption of prejudice if the defendant's attorney fails to provide an adversarial environment for the defendant, which is exactly what happened in this case. You know, even if he would have made an argument, that argument is nullified because of the fact that there was no bill of exceptions. You can't make an argument to the appeals court, the appellate court.
You mean no statement of errors?
Yes, no statement of errors. You know, that precludes you from being able to even make that argument. That's it, if you don't have any more questions.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much.